So with all this weather changing then, it brings in a whole new host of risks and problems and things for our pets, doesn't it?
It does. I mean, the main things that happen is you've now started getting the grass starting to grow and that sort of thing. As the weather starts to warm up, you get more, you know, more flowers starting to come out on the trees. You get pollen allergies. So we start to see a lot of animals coming in at this time of the year and onwards. So this is really the very start of it. But from here on in, we start getting quite a lot of dogs and cats coming in that have allergy problems. And it might be an allergy to, you know, a particular pollen on a certain tree that's only there for a few weeks. So, yeah, it could be that when the rape fields are in and starting to bloom and that, you suddenly find a big increase in animals that have watering eyes and conjunctivitis problems in the area where that rape field is. So there's lots of different areas where you can suddenly start to see a problem with pets associated with the growing and the renewal of plant life.
I've got to say, those the rape fields, I went away on Wednesdays. We were driving away from County Durham. You could see there was a hint of yellow on there. I came back on Friday and they were in full bloom. They've really gone for it this week, haven't they?
We had a little bit of a drive out. We went down to the Crab and Lobster at Azenby on Thursday for lunch, and driving down there and back, it's amazing to see the difference in the rape fields going further south compared to up here. The rape fields are probably another week or two on from here.
They just seem to be a season ahead, don't they?
They do.
20 miles south.
20 miles south. They've had a little bit more sunshine. They're up and away.
Yeah, absolutely.
Or the farmers were a little bit more efficient at getting them in.
Well, yes, that's also possible. If our pets, if they're suffering from allergies, what symptoms will you see? Are they like humans? Do you see streamy eyes and runny noses?
If you can just get a straight hay fever type effect, and the straight hay fever effect is literally just the streaming eyes and nose. Sometimes we end up having to use just antihistamines for those sort of ones, and they can be quite effective where you're just getting that sort of the hay fever type effect. There's also eye drops that we can end up putting in to try and just soothe the eyes down a little bit. A lot of the time those eye drops will contain a steroid, just to stop the inflammatory process going on within the eye. The more serious is something called atopy. Now, atopy is where you're getting the body reacting against environmental pollens and that, where the dog or the cat suddenly starts scratching a lot. And the scratching can be non-stop. And classically what happens is that atopy will affect certain areas of the body. So you tend to find that it's legs, armpit, groin, ears, around the eyes that cause the major areas. And, classically you'll see, we talk about a dog will come in, and if you look on the back of the back of the carpus and that, they'll have lost a lot of the hair on the back of the carpus.
Hang on a minute.
Carpus is the wrist or the... So if you're looking at the wrist...
The bottom of the legs, between the leg and the foot.
That's right. So between the foot and before you get further up. So they lose a lot of hair in that area, and that's fairly classical. But it becomes a very, very itchy thing. So you tend to find that these animals will scratch themselves continuously. And historically, the way of treating those would have been looking at using steroids, or we've got another couple of drugs that we can use to try and settle them down. But we have had a new drug come out in the last 12 months that seems to be working tremendously at stopping the itch without causing anywhere near the side effect of the steroids, so we can avoid the steroids. But we need to still make sure that the diagnosis is correct, because there's other things that can cause them to itch as well. So you can end up with, as the summer moves on, you can see more animals that get contact with scabies, that type of thing, so little mites in the skin. And they will also itch tremendously, but the areas that they itch at are very different in comparison to a dog with atopy. But then there are blood tests and that type of thing that can be done as well to try and prove as to what you're allergic to. And if the blood test comes back and it shows that you're allergic to a particular plant or whatever, you might find that you can avoid that plant and you can manage it just purely environmentally by avoiding going in particular areas. A lot of the time it will also come back with allergies to mites, like household dust mites, that type of thing, which become a lot more difficult to be able to eliminate. You know, apart from getting rid of all your soft furnishings in the house, which we have had people do successfully, but it's a very huge investment for them to do it and not work. There's a huge range of different things, but there are blood tests that we can do as well, and that blood test can show you definitely as to whether the animal is allergic or not. And then following on from the blood tests, we can either do immunotherapy injections, which are basically trying to sensitize the pet to that particular allergen. So it means that, you know, say you're allergic to dust mites, and we give you an injection, and we give that injection initially weekly and then monthly, and in that injection is a very small amount of dust mite allergen.
Right.
So the body is reacting to the dust mite allergen in a normal way, so therefore it sensitizes the body to say, don't react against it, otherwise it's a normal thing.
So is that kind of a building up a resistance to it? Is that how it works?
Building up a resistance to it, building up a tolerance to it.
Uh-huh.
I don't know whether you saw the thing in the paper on the news recently where they were having children that were allergic to peanuts.
Right.
And by giving them very, very small amounts of peanuts and working up, they developed to the point where they were no longer allergic to peanuts.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Not something I would try at home necessarily if you had a peanut allergy.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, they were giving them an absolutely minute amount to begin with,
mm-hmm.
and waiting until they were definitely not reacting to that before they would increase the dose. So it's a little bit, you know, it's like a little bit of what is bad for you is good for you, as long as you have that little bit on a regular basis.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
If you suddenly get exposed to a lot of it, then you're in trouble.
Uh-huh. Are there some really common allergens? Because, I mean, the obvious thing with allergies is to avoid something, isn't it? And that's really not easy with your pets. In fact, it's almost impossible.
It's not. But, I mean, the main common allergies you get, the household ones, is your storage mites from food. So if you're feeding dried food, the storage mites will come into that dried food very, very quickly after you've opened the bag.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, when the cat or dog is eating that dried food, they'll be breathing in the mites as well as eating them. And it was thought originally that it was the breathing in of the mites that caused the main problem.
Mm-hmm.
Now I don't know that it's 100% convinced as to whether it is breathing it in or whether it's eating it as well.
Right.
So households, you've got your different storage mites, you've got your house dust mites. Outside of the house, the main things you're getting is like all the different grasses. So there's a lot of the different grasses that can cause allergy problems. You've then got a lot of your trees, so your oak trees, that type of tree.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of them that have pollens that produce allergies. Now, there's probably an awful lot more allergies out there than we're actually aware of, because we test a panel that contains probably about 50 different allergies that are specific allergies. And we're testing to see whether the animal has any of those specific allergies.
Mm-hmm.
But there's hundreds of other things that could cause an allergy response that aren't on that panel, because they're not known to be, allergic in a big way. But you'll never see if you've got a new puppy this year and you're taking it out for a walk, you're not going to see a problem with atopy this year.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Because this year the puppy is naive, it doesn't have an allergic response to it. So you'll never see an allergic response going on with atopy in the first year usually.
Mm-hmm.
Come the second year, you'll get your puppy and he's now 11, 12 months of age. And you're starting to go out, and you're starting to find he's scratching, he's starting to get problems with the eyes, starting to get various of the problems. And it could well be that puppy is starting to become atopic, because the first year is the year that you become sensitized, the second year is the year you become allergic.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Right. Of course, I mean, they're so easy to buy antihistamines over the counter. Is there a problem with giving pets human drugs?
There's a problem with giving pets human drugs in a large degree.
Mm.
But antihistamines, antihistamines like Pyriton, realistically there isn't a problem with that in the vast majority of dogs.
Mm.
We use Pyriton every now and again, but we've got a number of animals that are on something called chlorpheniramine, which is Pyriton basically. And 4 milligram tablet taken a couple of times a day won't cause a problem for the vast majority of dogs. So you can cope with that without any trouble whatsoever. The downside of it is it only works, apart from hay fever type, it only works with atopy in about 10% of cases. So therefore 90% of them won't actually give you resolution, but 10% might. Yeah, so yeah, we always tend to start fairly simple. So we start with things like antihistamines and that, because if it works, it's a very simple way of controlling.
Well, that makes sense. And I guess you've got to get the dosage right as well. You don't want to be given a miniature dog the same dose as a dachshund, as a Great Dane, do you?
No, the dose of antihistamines is fairly standard at around about the 4 milligram per animal, but you've got a little bit of a cut-off. Yeah, if you're dealing less than 10 kilos, I certainly wouldn't give a full tablet. Yeah, you'd need to give lower. But I wouldn't necessarily ever increase it above that, even with a very big animal, because the chance of it working would be fairly low anyway. And they tend to work. It's not always dose-respondent as to how antihistamines work.
Right. And have you taken them yourself? Because they send me to sleep. Is that normal? I have some very sleepy pets.
Yeah, antihistamines, I haven't taken them myself. I don't have any allergy problems that way. But in general, antihistamines do make some people rather dozy.
I prefer the word sleepy, thank you.
Sorry.
But I do know what you mean.
Well, I could have used the word dopey. It would have sounded a lot worse, wouldn't it?
Yeah, well, no, not really. I think everybody knows I'm dozy. Right, I'm in the studio this morning with Paul Wilson, our local vet. Good morning, Paul.
Morning, Julian.
Are you raring to get out in this sunshine, are you?
Oh, I am. I'm definitely in need of sunshine at the moment.
You're going to be out and about today. Are you got anything nice planned?
I think we're having a wander through Gainford Village later on.
Yeah,
we haven't been there for a little while. Yeah, and we've got my mother-in-law and father-in-law up at the moment, so we're going to take them down to Gainford and have a little wander around the village there.
That sounds good. There's a bridge in Gainford. We were talking about this last weekend on the show. There's a bridge. There's an art competition about how you paint this bridge. The bridge is 100 years old or whatever. It's really ancient. So you'll have to have a look out for that.
It
must be quite a picturesque spot. There is some
lovely little spots down there. If you have a wander through, it's well worth a lazy afternoon.
Yeah, it sounds perfect. It does. So, Paul, we're talking about pet allergies. Go on.
Yeah, we're talking about different allergies and how to go about recognising them and how to go about treating them. But when you're dealing with allergies, the main thing that people tend to see is that their pet is just scratching all the time. And because the pet is scratching all the time, it's then a case of trying to see as to why is the pet scratching. Is it something that's a pollen? Is it something that is something environmentally? Is it that they've caught some sort of infectious disease? And a big part of the control of any atopy is to do with fleas, because flea allergic dermatitis is one of the most common things that we see in the veterinary surgery over the summer. And fleas are very easily controlled now. And they're getting a lot easier with new products coming out. There's a new product coming out that I went to a launch of earlier on last month. That sounds very exciting. It's a tablet just given once a month. Once every 3 months. You can combine your worming and flea control at the same time and just give a tablet of each once every 3 months.
That sounds good.
And it does all your ticks and your fleas and everything for the whole 3 month period. Plus, it can be used when they're pregnant. It can be used when they're lactating. It can be used in breeding. So it looks quite exciting. Which, using the word exciting and flea control, doesn't necessarily do it for most people. But
no, I'm with you.
from my point of view, we've got a product that's coming out that looks like it is extremely safe and lasts 3 months. So, we've got an order in to actually have it in stock, but it's not available just yet, but it should be available any time now.
Will it only be vet prescribed, or
it'll be a veterinary only prescription to begin with? Any completely new compound will be a prescription only item to begin with. With any of these compounds, as time goes on and they've been around a lot longer and people know what sort of safety margins there is and everything like that, Eventually, a lot of products do become, you know, a little bit more available, as far as it won't be vet only anymore. So if you take Frontline for an example, which is a product that's been around for now nearly 20 years, it's a drug, fipronil, which when it first came out worked absolutely wonderful. It was the safest product we ever had for flea control. The effectiveness of it now is not as good as it was then, but it's still fairly good. But it's now available through every channel. You can pick it up from the chemist, you can pick it up from the vets, you can pick it up online, etc. So, yeah, so as drugs go on, as long as they've proven safety, they can then move into the mainstream channels and they can be available for anywhere. Hopefully we still sell it at a very competitive price to anyone else, but it expands, and it means that where people were using pet shop products before that weren't effective, they've now got a pet shop product that can be effective. So it's not a problem from the animal's point of view. That's a great thing.
What should we be looking for then, if we, you know, my cat, what should I be looking for to see if he's got fleas? How should I be noticing?
Right, okay. The main thing you're going to notice with Jeffrey is that he's going to start scratching a little bit more. Right. The other thing that you may well notice as well is that people in the household start getting bitten. And if you've got fleas in the household, you'll usually start getting bitten between the ankle and the knee sort of thing. So you're suddenly getting little bite marks between the ankle and the knee. If you're getting that, you know you've waited too long to start flea control, because you've now got an infestation in the house that will take a lot longer to clear than just by preventing it on the animal.
So any visible signs, if he's scratching, then...
If he's scratching, what you tend to find is that they start getting hair loss, their hair, particularly on their back, so from the base of the tail upwards, that's called the flea zone. The hair there will often start to get quite thin, so they'll be licking on a very regular basis in that area. And because they're licking on a regular basis, the hair starts to become very, very thin and fall out. Also, the skin becomes quite thickened in that area because of the excessive licking. So, you know, your skin becomes abnormal and starts to get a little bit darker in colour.
Is it the same with dogs?
It's exactly the same with dogs.
So
with cats and dogs, as far as flea allergic dermatitis, it's very much the same. With cats, they also develop something called miliary dermatitis, which can be caused by fleas. And miliary dermatitis is where they get like little tiny spots all over the body. And those little spots all over the body start exuding protein, so you're getting like little crusty lesions all over, and the cat becomes very irritated. And the hair loss can be fairly universal because the cat is self-traumatizing and pulling it out. Now, you don't tend to see that with dogs. Dogs, you tend to find it just in the area on the back and that mall where the dog can get at. But with cats, you can get this true allergic response with fleas. Which is called miliary dermatitis. But miliary dermatitis doesn't have to be caused by a flea in the cat. It can be caused by anything that causes an allergic reaction penetrating the skin. So when we look at it and we go, oh, that's miliary dermatitis, we need to control your fleas, it may not be the fleas that's actually the cause of it or the trigger of it. But because fleas cause probably 85% of it, they have to be where you start treatment.
Okay, and if you've got to that state, What's the easiest, what's the quickest thing to do? How do you deal with it?
If you get to the state of miliary dermatitis, where you're getting these little lesions everywhere, what we do is we would look at starting on flea control using either a local product that you can put on the back of the neck or a tablet that they can be given to eat. We would then usually give a steroid injection that would last for a couple of weeks just to try and stop the actual inflammatory response in the skin. And we'd give you a household flea spray and go home and try and spray all the areas in the house. So initially it would be treated just purely as a probability of a flea problem. Moving on from there, you would then start using omega-3 fatty acids and that type of thing to try and decrease the sensitivity of the skin. And in cats, the supplementation with oils is really quite successful at trying to moderate how the skin reacts. In dogs, you can also, in cats as well, you can use topical shampoos, but trying to shampoo cats on a regular basis is a little bit of a difficult problem. I can't imagine you'd be able to shampoo Geoffrey very often, would you?
Oh, we do. Oh, he loves it. He loves water.
Oh, well, Geoffrey seems to be a little bit unique.
He thinks he's a tiger. Yeah. That's what it is.
No, he's a little bit unique if he likes to have a bath and that.
Yeah.
There's a lot of dogs don't like having a bath, but the idea of using a shampoo and that on a dog that's allergic like that on a regular basis is you're cleansing the skin and you're removing a lot of the pollens that are actually on the surface of the skin. And if you're using the right type of shampoos, you're actually also repairing the barrier of the skin.
Mm-hmm.
So if you can repair the skin barrier, it means that it's less likely to react to whatever is causing the allergy. And there are a number of shampoos that we can use that will do that very, very effectively.
Yeah. And just a quick question. You mentioned either drops or tablets. Which ones are the most effective?
The one that the owner can use the easiest.
Right. Well, that's taking it yourself.
When they've done trials and they've looked at the effectiveness of the droppers on the back of the neck,
mm-hmm.
in laboratory situations, the droppers are exceedingly effective.
Mm-hmm.
Right? In the household situation, they're not as effective as they are in the laboratory.
Right.
But the reason for that is that the owners don't necessarily apply it quite the way it's applied in the laboratory.
Mm-hmm.
So when you're applying a dropper onto the skin on the back of the neck, it's not just onto the back of the neck, but it's making certain that the content stays near the skin, right?
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of the time what will happen is people will grab hold of the pipette, give it an almighty squeeze in one spot.
Mm-hmm.
The liquid goes onto the back of the neck, it comes up over the hair, it runs down the side, it goes on the floor, and they get, right, I've put the flea control on.
Mm-hmm.
What they've effectively done is put some of the flea control on, and the rest of it isn't going to be effective. So when you're putting it on, what you're needing to do is you're needing to make sure that you're actually just squeezing the pipette just very gently to begin with, allow it to distribute itself, staying near the skin.
Mm-hmm.
If it starts to come up a little bit on the hair, leave that spot, move an inch or two further away,
mm-hmm.
and start again.
Mm-hmm.
All right? But by putting it on just very, very slowly and gently, it means then that the compliance rate at being able to kill the fleas and that
mm-hmm.
is tremendously higher.
Right. Well, that's good advice, isn't it?
Now, a lot of animals don't like the idea of the dropper being put on. So, you know, if I take my cats, for example, they're not mm-hmm. keen on having the dropper put on the back of the neck.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so I've switched to trying to use tablets with them, but unfortunately, one of them is sick with the tablet, so he has to get back on the droppers.
Right.
So, you know, it's variable as to what you need in your own environment, but also the product you use depends on where you're going to go lifestyle-wise.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you're going to be dogs, it's a little bit different to cats in that most cats have got the same sort of lifestyle.
Mm-hmm.
So most cats, it's going to be more flea control than anything else.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're going to take your dog down to Hamsley on a regular basis, you're going to go over the Lake District, you're going to go up to Scotland, you need to worry about tick control as well.
Mm-hmm.
If you're going to be just living in Bishop Auckland and you've got your backyard that you're going to go out into every now and again, then you don't necessarily need to have the tick control, but you might be more worried about slugs and snails.
Right.
So therefore, you might be worried about prevention of heartworm and lungworm, sorry. So by trying to prevent the lungworm, we haven't got a product that will currently do lungworm and ticks at the same time. So you'd need two different lots of products,
mm-hmm.
or you focus on the one that your pet would be most at risk at. Because if you're getting ticks transmitting onto your pet, you've got a myriad of different problems can come from having the tick on the animal,
mm-hmm.
As far as different infections and that. Now, in this area, we're quite lucky in that the main ticks that we've got in this area don't tend to carry an awful lot of disease.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're in parts of the Lake District, etc., there's a lot more prevalence of tick-borne disease in some areas than there is around here.
Right. So we should be looking at doing something for those pets before we take them away, maybe?
Yeah, I mean, this is where this new product is actually going to work quite well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I'm not trying to deliberately plug the new product, but by having something that will have 100% kill on fleas and ticks for a 3-month period, and you know you've applied it properly as long as the animal has eaten it,
mm-hmm.
It solves an awful lot of mm-hmm. compliance problems. The biggest problem we have is because putting the droppers on the back of the neck and that type of thing is something you have to remember to do once a month, We're not all that great at doing it on the day once a month. I know I'm as guilty as anyone by, you know, fudging the odd day every now and again.
You need a calendar.
You do need a calendar, I suppose. Yeah. Or you need a set day of the month where you usually do it.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It's just a case if you get past that day of the month and go, did I do it or not?
Yeah. Did I remember to treat the car?
Didn't remember. Yeah, but I'm only human. I can forget as well.
So we're talking animals and allergies and fleas, and I've been scratching like fury.
Yeah.
We're talking about that. I'm sorry.
So do you want us to move the topic away from that then, to stop you scratching?
I think you're going to have to, but don't move it to chicken pox. Or I'll start again.
Okay, what I'll do is we'll move on to a topic that has had a few people worrying. I don't think we've talked about this at the moment.
Okay.
There's been quite a bit of press recently about something called Alabama rot. Have we talked to you about Alabama rot? Yes.
Called what?
Alabama rot.
I've never heard of it. We can't have.
Okay. Well, I didn't think we'd talked about it yet. Uh-huh. But Alabama rot is something that is, it's not a new disease, and that it's been about for a few years now in this country. But it was identified in America quite a long time, or quite a while ago, in Alabama, which is why it's called Alabama rot. And what Alabama rot is, it's a disease that dogs can pick up, and it is a dog problem, not a cat problem.
Mm-hmm.
It's a disease that dogs pick up from when they've been walking in the woods. And they're not 100% certain as to what causes the disease yet, but it starts out with lesions mainly on the legs, sometimes on the face,
mm-hmm.
and they start out as just a little scratch. And what they think is happening is that they think it's an E. coli bacteria and rotting vegetation and where it's been very wet, and that the dogs get a scratch that gets infected with this E. coli bacteria. And that the bacteria then produces toxins within the bloodstream,
mm-hmm.
and those toxins can then lead to kidney failure.
Right.
So it's something that's it's mainly down in the New Forest, but there have been cases recorded in County Durham as well.
Mm-hmm.
And it's something that we would have been telling people, look, you know, yes, it's been recorded in County Durham, but we've not come across any cases. We have in the last month had a couple of dogs in that could quite easily have been Alabama rot, in that they've been 2 or 3 years of age, they've had a wound on their leg that they've got from walking in the woods.
Mm-hmm.
That wound then festers, it effectively ulcerates, so it looks really quite nasty. And these dogs have then developed complete kidney failure within a period of a couple of weeks.
Wow.
Yeah, so if there's a blood test done early enough and it's identified as being kidney failure before it gets to too big a degree,
mm-hmm.
then a lot of them can be saved by putting them on intravenous fluids,
mm-hmm.
And trying to specifically treat the kidneys. The unfortunate thing in these dogs was that the time from injury to blood testing was a little bit too long to actually be able to do anything too much to save them. Yeah, so what I would say to people is that don't say you can't go to the woods or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's not something that is an epidemic that's going to cause a lot of problems. You've got your dog. Your dog needs to enjoy their life. They still mm-hmm. need to. Yeah, you still need to enjoy your dog.
Mm-hmm.
But if you do get a lesion that you've got a wound on the leg or got a wound on the face and it's starting to fester after a day or so, don't just ignore it and try and treat it. It's worthwhile having it looked at, and if they're given early antibiotics but no anti-inflammatory painkillers or anything like that, and if there is any increase at all in drinking that's been seen, mm-hmm. they should have a blood test to check the kidney function.
Right,
uh-huh. So it's changing the way that we're viewing a little bit. Traditionally, if we've had dogs coming in with a wound on the leg or whatever, you would try and treat the wound of the leg. You wouldn't do a blood test straight away.
Mm-hmm.
Because by doing the blood test straight away, you're costing the owner an extra 50-odd quid.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a lot of money to spend if it's going to be normal.
Mm-hmm.
But unfortunately, with this disease, the only way you're going to actually cure them is by identifying that that's what it is very early on. And the only way of doing that is doing the blood test.
Mm-hmm.
So, what we're suggesting is that where a dog is coming in and has had a wound that is possible as far as You know, they've been walking in the woods somewhere. Mm-hmm. They've got a wound. The wound is festering, and often they actually ulcerate. Mm-hmm. Right. So, by ulcerating, instead of just staying as a little spot, mm-hmm. they actually the skin around it seems to melt.
Right.
Right. And it's the melting of the skin that is caused by the toxin.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And the toxin then causes a similar sort of effect within the kidney.
Mm-hmm.
So it can actually block out the kidneys very, very quickly.
Right. Mm. Is it mainly picked up in woodland areas then?
It seems to be associated with woodland walks.
Right.
Right. So, yeah, and they're not quite sure what it was caused by.
Mm-hmm.
The theories originally were that this was some sort of fungal toxin that the mm-hmm. dogs were picking up. But the most common theory at the moment seems to be that it's a bacteria and that it's a form of a toxic E. coli bacteria,
mm-hmm.
and that it's the toxins coming from that then cause the problems.
Mm-hmm.
But the key is antibiotics will usually eliminate the infection itself,
mm-hmm.
but it's then trying to control the kidney problems that come as a result of it.
Mm-hmm.
But it's one of these diseases where there's quite a wide range of possible symptoms that have been put into this complex called Alabomerot. But until they can actually get a diagnostic test to prove that that's what it is, then there's going to be a lot of cases like the couple that we've had in the last fortnight or so that are going to be put on the list as being possibles. Now, they're put on the list as possibles because to see dogs that go into kidney failure at 3 years of age is not usual,
mm-hmm.
right? Not acute kidney failure. And to see them where they've had problems where they've got wounds on their legs and that
mm-hmm.
Preceding going into the kidney failure means that, for all probability, they are probably related to the Alabomerot.
Mm-hmm.
We've always seen the odd dog that went into kidney failure young. But you're talking 2 or 3 a year at the most, not suddenly getting a couple in a couple of days.
Right.
So statistically it could be that it was just chance.
Mm-hmm.
But there does seem to be a problem within this area.
Mm-hmm.
Although talking to the owners involved in these dogs, they hadn't walked in the same area.
Right.
So it wasn't that we can mm-hmm. say, well, don't walk at a particular spot because mm-hmm. that's where these dogs walked. They'd been in the woods, but they've been in different woods in different areas.
Yeah, that was going to be my next question. Is there anywhere to avoid?
No, it's too early days to say. You have to build up a calendar of saying, mm-hmm. right, okay, whereabouts have there been animals mm-hmm. affected?
Mm-hmm.
And if you can build up a calendar and you said, say, for instance, Hamsley Forest, mm-hmm. That if you went on X trail, the dogs mm-hmm. were all on this particular trail that got it.
Mm-hmm.
Then you get to run again. Well, there must be a problem in that area.
Mm.
And I'm not saying Hampshire Forest is even connected to any of them,
mm.
right? But it's just an area where people would recognise by saying.
Yeah.
But if you can identify the underlying pattern behind it, then you can hopefully pick up where the problem is.
Mm.
We did have a dog about 2 or 3 years ago, a lovely pointer that came in that had an infected toe, and then it went on to develop kidney failure within weeks of that.
Mm-hmm.
At the time, it was before Alabomerot was supposed to be around, and had never been in the woods, but they've mm-hmm. got a paddock of their own. And you query, could that have been mm-hmm. a case?
Mm-hmm.
Or was that completely unrelated?
Mm-hmm.
But, I would think that was probably unrelated.
Mm-hmm.
But we're getting something that's causing, some sort of toxic acute renal failure in dogs
mm-hmm.
That's associated with an infection.
When you get epidemics or problems like this in an area, who catalogues it to see where a problem's starting to develop? How is it recorded?
Right, okay. It's the recording of it isn't terribly scientific at this stage.
Yeah.
There is a couple of groups that are trying to get cases logged with them,
mm-hmm.
right? So the cases that we've had, I think, have been logged as possibles. But because we haven't got the full pathology on them or anything like that, we can't say that these are absolutely, definitely Alabomerot cases.
Right? Mm-hmm.
But to get the full pathology, it doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to be Yeah, absolutely there either. You'd have to do a post-mortem, you'd have to histopathology on the kidneys, and all that sort of thing. And, and if people are in a position that they've just lost their pet, often the last thing they want to do is to have their pet cut about. You know, they've lost their pet, they've had it talked about as this disease as being the probable, and, you know, if you say to them, you know, on the matter of research, we would like to do this, that and the other, a lot of the time that's a little bit too far.
Yeah. Well, that's understandable, I guess. People care a lot about their animals, don't they?
They do. They care an awful lot about them. And it's the, yeah, if we could say when we do this pathology test and it proves 100% that your animal had this disease, it would be a little bit different because we could then push it.
Yeah.
But we can't say that because there is no 100% identification of Alabama rot at the moment. There's a series of things that happen, a series of clinical signs, a series of events that can be tied in that are put into a syndrome. So until they can identify actually what is it that's causing the problem and exactly how is it causing the problem, things are a little bit up in the air.
Yeah, absolutely. Right, Paul, thank you very much for that. That's been absolutely fantastic.